Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1400 hours GMT on Monday the 4th of November, these are our main stories. India's top court criticises politicians for failing to tackle toxic smog in the capital, Delhi. Sudan's new prime minister has become the most senior official to visit camps for displaced people in Darfur. The trial begins in New Zealand of a man accused of murdering a young female British backpacker. Also in this podcast, from a spoonful of sugar to a hill alive with music, we go behind the scenes of some of Hollywood's biggest movies with actor Julie Andrews. First to India, where the capital, Delhi, is under a blanket of the worst air pollution experienced there for 3 years. The hazardous fog, described as eye-burning, has triggered traffic restrictions and school shutdowns as millions struggle to go about their daily lives. Experts say breathing the air in Delhi is similar to smoking up to 50 cigarettes a day. India's top court has called on politicians to take action, and the World Health Organization's Director for Public Health and Environment, Dr. Maria Nehra, told the BBC that more needs to be done.
It's a question now to take those measures, escalate it, and create a coordination among the different authorities. It's true that it's not an easy task, but we know very well what are the sources of pollution. We know who are the ones that are most affected, and sometimes it's related to poverty and the fact that they don't have the resources to do it differently. But I think with a very strong political will, with a coordination, the Indians have a very good, a very strong plan on how to deal with the air pollution.
Delhi's chief minister says the city has turned into a gas chamber. These people there explained how it's affecting lives.
Yeah, anyhow, it is affecting our life. I'm getting eye problem from last few days, getting cold and all.
Yes, I think it's an emergency situation because the dust from the construction buildings. Obviously, we are worried for my family, my kids. So I have a 2 months daughter, so I've not taken her out, and 24/7 the air purifier is running in the room, so obviously it's an alarming situation.
Pratiksha Gildial, our correspondent in Delhi, told us how traffic bans are rolling out.
It's just the first day of the ban today. So under the scheme, from today until the 15th November, only cars with either odd or even number plates will be allowed on the roads each day. We did see relatively less traffic in parts of the city today. But whether this will actually make any difference is the question, because the scheme has been tried before and there is some skepticism, some doubt whether it really helps. Because remember, vehicular pollution is only one of the factors that causes Delhi's pollution. There are other factors like construction activities, and one of the major reasons is said to be the stubble burning by farmers in neighboring states of Delhi, who say that this is the only way they can clear their fields to make way for new harvest, and as a result of which the smoke from there comes to Delhi and just hovers and hangs over the city for days on end. Now, whether today's scheme of restricting traffic will make any difference, it'll have to be seen. I think it'll take a few days and readings over the next few days whether it'll make a difference. But there's a lot of skepticism that when the pollution is so off the charts, you really need much more drastic measures.
Well, you say much more drastic measures. I mean, India's top court seems to be clear where the blame lies, at the feet of politicians.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people do say that it's partly the lack of collective political will to implement any long-term solutions. Now, remember, Delhi, of course, being the capital, gets all the, you know, hogs all the headlines. But the problem is all over North Indian plains. Most polluted North Indian regions are governed by different political parties. And, you know, they just seem to indulge in a blame game. Delhi will say, well, it's the states of Haryana and Punjab causing the problem. Haryana and Punjab will say, well, we've done our bit. We've given some modern equipment to farmers to dispose of their stubble. But what about your vehicular pollution and your industrial pollution? Also remember, in India, despite the high level of pollution, we haven't seen it become an election issue. We had the general election this year. None of the parties, I mean, it wasn't a major issue in any of their manifestos. So Indians don't seem to vote on this, even though it's a public health emergency. And as a result, there seems to be no long-term political will to find a solution.
Pratiksha Gildial. Now to the latest about the investigation into the 39 people found dead in a lorry in southeast England. Police in Vietnam have arrested 8 more suspects in connection with the case, bringing the total of those detained in the country to 10. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
There's 2 parts to it. The first part of it is seeking out the people who are responsible for trafficking these migrants to Britain in the first place. As you mentioned there, Vietnam has now arrested 8 people from central provinces where many of these migrants are thought to have originated from. That's 2 extra people who were arrested on Friday in Vietnam. In addition to that, we have 2 people facing manslaughter charges, one in Britain, one in Ireland. The person in Ireland is hoping to be, or the police are hoping to extradite him to the United Kingdom. In tandem, we have the process of trying to identify the people found in the back of the lorry. And we have a group of Vietnamese officials who have just arrived in London to help British police with that. At the moment, there's been no formal identification, but some families in Vietnam that have reported their family members were missing have spoken to the police in Britain. And after that conversation, they believe that their loved ones were aboard that container. Also, we have some good news for a few Vietnamese families who were missing relatives. They've subsequently found that their relatives were elsewhere and they were not among the dead.
Michael Bristow. In Sudan, the new leader, Abdalla Hamdok, has gone to see the refugee camps in Darfur for himself. He's the most senior government figure to do so since the war there in 2003. The former president, Omar al-Bashir, had been unwelcome at the camps. Mr. Hamdok took up his post promising to bring peace and economic stability to Darfur. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, has been following his visit.
The Prime Minister visited 2 camps in the Darfur region, and many people will remember the conflict which began there way back in 2003. And it seems pretty staggering to think that there are still 1.5 million people living in camps. So he went to speak to some of the victims of the conflict and to listen to their concerns. Some of them talked about wanting justice for the crimes that had gone on over all these years. But he promised that he and his government were going to work to ensure that there was lasting peace and the economy could be rebuilt. In other words, you can have a normal life again. That's what we're going to try and sort out for you. And the reason it's so significant is that because the former president Omar al-Bashir was so hated there in Darfur, because he was accused of being in charge, basically, of a campaign where ethnic cleansing was used to put down a rebellion and terrible atrocities were carried out against entire villages. He was so hated, he couldn't even step foot in these camps. So it's significant that Abdalla Hamdok has gone there in person and he's been welcomed in the camps themselves.
But I suppose what they'll want is action next.
They want action. Obviously, the key thing for them is to get out of the camps, and that will be a monumental task, because some of the land that they ran away from, the villages they ran away from, has now been seized by other groups. So there's a huge land problem to sort out. But as I mentioned, some of them also calling for justice and even saying, you know, we want the former president, Mr. Bashir, to be held to account for the war crimes. That, it seems, is unlikely to happen, partly because there are very key figures who are still important in Sudan who were part of Mr. Bashir's security apparatus, including one man known as Hameti, who is some people think is the most powerful person in Sudan now. He was in charge of the militia, the Janjaweed militia, that carried out a lot of those atrocities in Darfur.
Will Ross. As wildfires rage once again in California, the governor of the western U.S. state has brushed off renewed criticism from President Trump over his handling of the situation. Mr. Trump is threatening to withhold federal aid to California, blaming the fires on what he said was Gavin Newsom's mismanagement of its forests. Peter Bowes reports from Los Angeles.
Donald Trump's claim that California's governor has done a terrible job of forest management reflects an ongoing hostile relationship between the president and Gavin Newsom. According to Mr. Trump, the governor should be cleaning the forest floors, regardless of what his bosses, the environmentalists, demand of him. Mr. Newsom responded with a pointed tweet of his own, directed at the president. "You don't believe in climate change," he says. "You are excused from this conversation." Several of this year's major wildfires have burned in parts of California where there are no forests.
Peter Bowes. A man has gone on trial in New Zealand, accused of murdering the British backpacker Grace Mullane, who went missing in Auckland while travelling after graduating from university here in the UK. Her body was found in bushes near a tourist area. The killing shocked New Zealand and sparked intense debates about violence against women. Annika Smith from Radio New Zealand has been updating Nick Qureshi on the case.
She disappeared from Auckland CBD on the eve of her 22nd birthday, which sparked a large police investigation. Her family in Essex initially grew worried for her when she wasn't responding to birthday messages. A police investigation ended in the discovery of her body buried in the Waitakere Ranges about a week after she went missing. And a 27-year-old man who has interim name suppression has been charged with murdering her.
And this man has name suppression. Why?
This defendant was granted interim name suppression in the Auckland District Court right after he was charged, and that's continued on the basis of preserving his fair trial rights. In New Zealand, that's an option. It's up to a judge to decide whether someone is eligible for interim name suppression or permanent name suppression. In this case, it is on an interim basis, and that's to preserve his fair trial rights and to ensure that he gets a fair trial and that things aren't opened up for an appeal in the future.
And what has happened in court today?
The very start of the trial, so we got a large jury pool brought in. Seven women and five men were selected. Then the court was adjourned until Wednesday. And on Wednesday is really going to be the big day when the Crown will open its case. And actually we heard today that David Mullane, Grace's father, will be giving evidence as well.
And this case has had a huge impact on New Zealand, hasn't it?
I think for New Zealanders, it's quite common to go on a big OE overseas, you know, exploring the world. So many sympathised with Grace Mullane and her family. But as Justice Moore, the trial judge, said today, he made a very clear direction to the jurors that they have to put aside prejudice and sympathy and take their role as judges of the facts very seriously in this case, and more so in this case because of the intense media scrutiny that it's had.
Annika Smith from Radio New Zealand in Auckland.
Nous arrivons dans Ravensbrück et on voit ce grand portail que vous avez vu sur Dieu.
The voice of Yvette Lundy, a World War II French resistance fighter and concentration camp survivor who's died at the age of 103. Europe's largest budget airline, Ryanair, has reported profits of €1 billion for its half-year results, but it's treading carefully when it comes to future predictions. That's partly because the company bought a fleet of Boeing 737 MAX jets, which were then grounded after two deadly crashes. The Ryanair chief executive, Michael O'Leary, has been speaking to the BBC about the impact that has had on his company.
I mean, at this point in time, we expect to only take delivery of 20 aircraft before the summer 2020 peak, whereas originally we were scheduled with Boeing to take 60 aircraft. So we'll carry more passengers next summer, but at the growth rate will slow significantly. We think we'll grow next year now by maybe 2 or 3%, as originally we were forecast predicting growth of 7%.
So what's this going to cost you, do you think? And will you be pursuing Boeing for some sort of compensation?
Well, I mean, the dialogue with Boeing continues. I think there will be some costs that we will have to recover from Boeing. We're working closely with Boeing and with EASA, the regulator here in Europe, to ensure that the MAX is back flying, hopefully well in advance of summer 2020. But the date keeps moving backwards. I mean, we originally were expecting to get our first aircraft in January of next year. Now it's back to March, maybe April. And there's a real risk we might not have any of these aircraft in time for the summer 2020 season. is, you know, we've been closing bases this winter in the Canaries, some bases in Germany, because we're short of aircraft for next summer. Even if we get the 20, we're still down 30 or 40 aircraft. I think it would just, you know, if we get none of these aircraft in time for next summer, it just means slower growth. But slower growth and less capacity means, unfortunately, higher airfares. It would be bad for our customers in the short term, good for our shareholders, but we would prefer to continue to grow by lowering airfares. At some point in time next year, the MAX will go back flying. It's a perfectly safe aircraft. It's a great aircraft. It carries 4% more passengers, but it's 16% lower fuel. And in a period of, you know, concern about the environment, any investment we can make that will significantly reduce our fuel consumption is good for our profits and good for the environment as well.
Ryanair Chief Michael O'Leary speaking there to Sally Bundock. McDonald's global chief executive Steve Easterbrook has been fired for having a relationship with another employee. The British businessman, who's based in the US, told staff that he'd violated the company's rules. The fast food company, like many US employers, doesn't allow managers to have romantic relationships with direct or indirect employees. The newsroom's Charlotte Gallagher reports.
In an email to staff, Steve Easterbrook described the relationship with an unnamed employee as a mistake. Even though it was consensual, the board of McDonald's said it violated company policy. Steve Easterbrook was hired as chief executive in 2015 and has been widely credited with turning around the company's financial fortunes. The value of shares more than doubled during his tenure. He remodeled the business, striking a lucrative delivery deal with Uber Eats and installing digital ordering kiosks in restaurants. Although last month the company missed Wall Street profit estimates for the first time in 2 years. The Me Too movement has led to increased scrutiny of powerful businessmen, and Steve Easterbrook isn't the first executive to be forced out because of a relationship deemed to be inappropriate. Last year, the former chief executive of Intel, Brian Krzanich, resigned for the same reason.
Charlotte Gallagher. Tributes have been circulating online for Yvette Landy, a well-known member of the French Resistance and a Nazi concentration camp survivor who's died at the age of 103. She passed away on Sunday in the northern French town of Epernay, where the mayor paid tribute on social media, saying Ms. Landy represented the honour of France during the darkest hours of our history. Ms. Landy famously said of her experience in a concentration camp, "You're like a hole full of emptiness, and if you look around, it's more emptiness." Here's our reporter, Kate Gregan.
Nous arrivons dans Ravensbrück et on voit ce grand portail que vous avez vu sur des dans des livres.
That was Yvette Lundy describing her experience of arriving at the Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany in 1944. As a resistance worker in occupied France in 1940, Ms. Lundy began supplying forged papers to Jews, men fleeing the Nazis' forced labour programme and escaped prisoners of war. But 4 years later, at the age of 28, she was arrested by the Gestapo, the secret police of Nazi Germany, and transported to Ravensbrück, a camp near Berlin specifically for women, where between 30 and 50,000 people died. Over the years, Ms. Lundy spoke of the dehumanisation she experienced there, a memory she said she would never forget was being forced to undress in front of SS officers at the very beginning of her ordeal. Her trauma at the camp would last nearly a year until she was assigned to a commando slave labour unit that was liberated by the Russian army in April 1945. It was nearly 15 years before she began to speak out about her experiences, giving talks to French and German students, dedicating her life to reconciliation.
There is hope. Remind yourselves that in life and during a war, the struggle is for freedom, and there is a duty to respect freedom, to respect skin colour, religion, political ideas, and to know how to tolerate others. Respecting oneself and respecting others, that is freedom.
On the occasion of her 100th birthday, Ms. Lundy was awarded the Legion of Honour's second highest level, that of Grand Officer. Ms. Lundy died at the age of 103 in the northern French town of Epernay. The town's mayor paid tribute to her incredible commitment to the duty of remembrance.
Kate Gregan. While Yvette Landy was helping the resistance during World War II, a woman in Greece, Melpomene Dina, was hiding a Jewish family of six in the northern city of Thessaloniki before helping them flee into the mountains. The two surviving siblings, Sarah and Yossi, who both live in Israel, brought their 20 children and grandchildren to the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem for an emotional meeting with Ms. Dina. Sarah paid this tribute.
They hid us in their house. They had quite a simple house, you could say. She, Malpanini Dina, was the youngest of the Saviour's kids. There is a six-year gap between us, so we became friends of around the same age. We played together, we picked vegetables from their garden together, and we sort of helped cooking. We did everything together.
The other surviving sibling was Yossi Mordecai. His grandson Yuval also praised Ms. Dina.
This woman and her sisters who took my grandfather's family and rescued them are, first of all, she's a woman for whom we owe a huge debt. And in addition to this, she's an inspiration for me. Her character is of heroism and courage, and also of simple humaneness, a humaneness that stands against the most horrible evil ever and simply looks at its face and prevails against it.
Yuval Mordecai, the grandson of a Holocaust survivor. It is 55 years since the actress Julie Andrews made her Hollywood debut as the nanny in the musical Mary Poppins. She went on to have many successful roles, including playing Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music. Now, the 84-year-old Oscar winner has written a book about her early career called Homework. She spoke to Nicola Stanbridge.
This is a memoir of your Hollywood years. Can you recall your first day on Walt Disney's set for Mary Poppins, aged 27?
I was so nervous, had no idea what I was doing. Dick Van Dyke was saying,
Mary Poppins, you look beautiful.
Do you really think so?
Cross my heart you do,
like the day I met you.
You look fine too, Bert.
And my ex-husband, Tony Walton, who designed all the sets and costumes, said, I think that Mary has a kind of secret life where her petticoats are quite colourful, and it gave me a great insight into how Mary might be a bit twinkly and sparkly inside.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious.
It was also dangerous. You describe plummeting onto the soundstage when wires gave way one day, letting fly a stream of colourful expletives.
The Disney studio was a little bit shocked when I spoke up. It wasn't as dangerous as it sounds because I was counterbalanced. But even so, I did fall pretty hard. Talk about an experience as a first film. I'd never made a movie before.
From the BBC archives in 1974, we can hear what Mary Poppins author P.L. Travers thought watching the film.
Oh, now you're asking me a very difficult and delicate question. I wept when I saw it. I thought, oh, what have I done? When I saw that name coming up, Mary Poppins, I thought, what have I done? And you must admit, it's not very like the books. But I've come to think, when I see the modern films that are available now, I come to think that there's quite a good deal to say for it.
I think it's very like the P.L. Travers that I met and knew a little bit. She called me the day after I'd given birth to my lovely daughter, Emma, and she said, I understand you're playing the part of Mary Poppins. And she said, well, you're far too pretty, of course, but you've got the nose for it. I don't think she ever thought about it as being a musical.
What did you think of Emily Blunt's Mary Poppins?
Oh, I loved it. It was a new story. It wasn't a recreation of the old one, really. I think it's time for another one, if you know what I mean.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
Truly, I don't sing, but instead, I include as much music as I can in our books. We read them on tape. A couple of them have been developed as musical pieces, and it certainly has compensated. Oh my, there's a lot out there still to be done.
Julie Andrews ending that report, speaking about her children's books. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.